a space helmet with, it was wonderful. I liked it. It was like, oh boy, this is great, you know. Anyway, it certainly was a different time then. Well, I did sort of like it. We'll have to work on that, I think. So I'm going to invite my Ubuntu friends to come up, if you would, and we're going to sing a song to you that is from Hawaii, and it's called May Great Peace Descend, or Ele Ele. So we're going to be talking about some strange stuff today, and we're, I know that makes you happy. So one of the things that we're going to talk about is the land of the soul. And so we're going to sing a song now that's called Return Again, and it's about dipping deep into the well of your spiritual life.
Return again. Return again, return to the land of your soul. Return to who you are, return to what you are, return to where you are, born and reborn again. Return again. Return again, return to the land of your soul. Return to who you are, return to what you are, return to where you was born and reborn again. Return to who you are, return to what you are, return to where you are, sword and reborn again. Return to who you are, return to what you are, return to where you are, sword and reborn again. Return to who you are, return to what you are, return to where you are, sword and reborn again. Return to who you are, return to what you are, return to where you are, sword and reborn again. Return to me.
and the world rejoice. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. When you were born, you cried, and the world rejoice. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice.
When you were born, you cried, and the world rejoiced. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. When you were born, you cried, and the world rejoiced. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. When you were born, you cried, and the world rejoiced. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice.
When you were born, you cried, and the world rejoiced. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice.
Now we're going to do the same, but wait a second. We're going to conduct an experiment.
Oh,
mine too. And so here's the deal. We're going to ask you to sing with us, and this singing is going to turn into a meditation. And so it's very important that you learn the lyrics. And so I'm going to teach them to you right now. And they are this. Breathe in. Breathe out. That's the lyrics. So you're going to sing that, and we're going to start you off, and then you keep singing that, and then we're going to add other stuff to it. So, Maestro, if you would give us a C note.
Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe.
You know, it's an interesting thing when we're born into two worlds. And the first one is the one that we know the most about because it's the world of our constant chatter in our head that's always going, discursive thoughts. And so we take that as our regular consciousness, like that's who we are. But underneath that, there is a deeper, more of a holy space within us. And in our regular self, the one that's ruled by discursive thought, it's all about measurements and weight and tangibles and all of these things that you can feel and touch and measure. But the other world is only measured by imagination and through your dreams and stuff that can't really be handled with words. Have you ever thought about this? How many times are you dreaming and it's really like a subtitle going on in your dreams? That really doesn't happen. It's presented to you all in one big blip. And so we don't need words to describe that. That's the thing that comes from that deep well within us that doesn't use language for communication. So there are times when our regular lives are interrupted. Something happens. Stuff hits the fan, and all of a sudden, the apple cart is turned over, and you're forced to look differently at things. I'm going to tell you the story of three different people today. Quick story. And the first one is Krishnamurti. And you probably have heard his name if you don't know who he was. But he was 7 years old when he got adopted, he and his brother. They were in India growing up. And a woman called Dr. Basant adopted him and his little brother. She was the leader of the Theosophical Society at the time. And so the Theosophical Society had gotten together and decided that they were going to be able to identify who the next Messiah is. And they said, it's Krishnamurti. So they adopted him, took him away from his parents for the most part, although he did get to visit on occasion. But his life was no longer his at that point, because they set about turning him into what they thought he should be as the future Messiah. So here's this kid, 7 years old. He must have been totally overwhelmed with this and given such an immense responsibility. What is he to do with this? And so from the time he was 7 years old until he was 32, he was managed by handlers, teachers, coaches, oh gosh, probably wardrobe specialists too. Anyway, he didn't really have his own life until one day what happened to him was his other world broke through. And all of a sudden he had this clear vision of what had happened to his life. And so it was like walking from absolute darkness into absolute brilliant light. So he was scheduled to speak at this big conference of the Theosophical Society. And it had been driving him nuts. And so finally, when he got up to speak, he said, I'm not who you think I am. Because I don't want to have anything more to do with this or any other religion. I don't want to be anybody special. I just want to be just like you are. And I'm going to do that from now on. Well, you can imagine the crisis that had created in the group. You know, they were thinking they were going to come to see the Messiah. And what he did was he suddenly showed his authentic self. No, here's who I really am. Do you like me or not? So it was kind of a big deal to think that that happened. It really sent that whole process in crisis. But what he did was he didn't just stop and go home. What he decided to do was to go out into the world and challenge people. Find the truth for yourself. You do it. Don't take somebody else's word for it. You dig deep. Find the truth within yourself. Show who you really are. It was a wonderful thing. He ended up dying pretty late in life. I think he taught for 60 years after that. He ended up living for a while in Ojai, California. And it's a little town sort of in the middle of nowhere, but it's very beautiful. I went there once, I think it was in 94, and when you walk into the place, it's the most serene place you'd ever be. It's beautiful. It's big old oak trees, you know, and it just looks ancient and it looks sacred. So that's where he would go back to sort of refill his cup before he went back out into the world again to challenge people to find their lives, find your true self, and show it to everyone else. So he's the first guy. I have to admire him for that. That took a lot of courage to stand up and do that. The second one is the Dalai Lama. He's probably the most famous Buddhist around today. If you say Dalai Lama, you have this little picture of the little guy, you know. He's 92 now. So the Dalai Lama sort of had the same thing happen to him. He was 2 years old when he got identified as the 14th Dalai Lama after the 13th died. Well, here's how they figured this out. The high lamas in Tibet got together after the death of the 13th Dalai Lama, and they visioned together. And so they sort of met and had an idea. When the 13th Dalai Lama was cremated, they watched the smoke to see which direction it went. And that was one of the indicators about where to look for the next Dalai Lama. And so what they did was this one Lama said, I have a vision of the house where he lives, and described it pretty much to a T, and the color of the shutters and what the front looked like and pretty much where it was, but not exactly. They knew the town. So here comes the Lama posse out looking for this kid. And so sure enough, they find this house that's just a dead ringer for the description they were giving. And so they went to the door. One of the parents came to the door and they said, "We think that your child is the next Dalai Lama." And they were flabbergasted, as you might imagine, because what that entailed is, you know, something like this. They had this little talk and they said, "We'll be back for him when he's 7. And so he's yours till then." So they did it. They went back. They got the Dalai Lama and they said to his parents, said, "Now you can come with us if you want to, or you can stay here and keep up the farm." And so they probably did both. So here was the 7-year-old kid. And again, he had handlers and teachers. He had to take all of these subjects that were just outrageous, you know, how to debate. He was a little older than 7 when he learned that. But he had to learn about the arts, theater, music, math, science, the sciences. And as he was growing up, he got to be around 15 years old, and people would bring gifts to him, you know, mostly people from Western countries would visit to meet this new Dalai Lama. And so they would bring him presents. One of the presents they brought him was a telescope. Now, he's a real nut for science. And growing up, he didn't really have access to much of anything. But when he got that telescope, it was the best thing he could have ever gotten. So not only did he look out from his window and watch the people across, but he would look at the stars and the moon. And when he was in class learning about the heavens, what he learned was that the moon gives off its own light. Well, that's not what we learned, and we know that it's a reflection. And so he was looking at his telescope, and he noticed that the moon was making shadows, like the little sharp points after, you know, like where a crater would be. And he noticed the shadows would move. And then he thought, well, that's what it does on Earth, too. And so all of a sudden he said, well, you know what? I think if the moon gave its own light, it wouldn't create shadows from that. It would shine out. And that was sort of the crack in the egg for him. Because he looked at all of the things that he'd been taught up to that point, and he said, some of this is not quite accurate. And so he said he had kind of a crisis over that. He said, do I teach what I've been taught? Do I go with that and stick with that? Or do I talk about what I have found out that's counter to what I've been taught? And so for him, that was the moment that sort of made him change directions. Instead of going straight by the book, he started listening to his own inner wisdom. And so he told the people around him, the other lamas, he said, well, you know, if this is not correct, we have a responsibility to make it so. And so they went around correcting a lot of the things that were known to science that were counter to what they were learning. Pretty incredible thing, I think. But he, you know, in 1950, when China took over Tibet, the Tibetan people and the higher-ups, the ruling class in Tibet, said, we want you to be our political leader from now on, not just religious, but political leader. So in 1950, he met with the Chinese authorities who were taking over Tibet, and he was going to try to say, let's come to some kind of agreement. Let's see what we can do to keep who we are, and still keep you happy. And so basically the Chinese said, no, we're not interested in that. And so it kept getting scarier and scarier in Tibet until they had to leave in the middle of the night walking to India, which was no small feat. But shortly after that, several of the monasteries were occupied by the Chinese army, and most of the monks were killed. And had it not been for the fact that they had that moment where they said, we have got to go, we have to go to keep Buddhism alive and to keep Tibet alive. And so they moved to India, set up the Parliament of India in exile. He made it totally democratic. He worked on making women equal to men in all of their endeavors in this new parliament. It was just quite a feat for them to be able to do that. But I imagine about the horror that must have been for them to see their friends be murdered or hear that they got murdered, that the whole monastery was wiped out. And it all started for him. His wisdom came from the fact that he did question and doubt and listen to his own inner wisdom. And that might have been, I don't know that this is the case, but that might have been why they got up and left in the middle of the night that one night. And it was not too long before the monasteries were just murder fields. The third person that I want to tell you about is the guy that started Buddhism, and he really had no intention of starting a religion. It was the last thing on his mind. He was miserable, which was kind of odd because he grew up being a rich boy. He had everything he wanted. There was nothing he lacked for. He had a brand new beautiful wife and later on a son that he loved dearly. And he was as happy as could be. He was destined, it looked like, to be the new ruler of his father's realm. And what happened was he said, is that all there is? Just, you know, having things and dancing women and, you know, is that all there is to life? And he managed to get out. His father didn't want him to do too much, go too far. But when he went out, he saw sick people. He'd never seen sick people before. And he would ask. He asked his driver. He said, well, what's wrong with that person? He said, he's sick. Said, what do you mean he's sick? He said, people get sick. They do? He was so naive because he was so sheltered. And then he saw somebody that was dead, and they were getting ready to cremate him. And he said, what's going on here? And he said, well, was so shocked, and all this really caused more and more angst and anger, because why didn't he know about this before? Why was he kept in the dark? Why did he not realize that life was about, you know, growing up, aging, at some point dying? He said, there's got to be more meaning to life than that. And so, also, middle of the night, he left, and he became a wandering beggar, a bhikkhu. And so he hung out with the yogis, and he learned everything he could from them. And at some point, he realized that there's more to more depth than they were teaching. And so finally, he came up with this, what could be considered more than a philosophy, but a way of life. And he said, well, you know, the reason why we're miserable as living humans is because we want too much. We're always wanting stuff. And you can't get enough. You just want more. If you're someone who collects musical instruments, like I am, you know, it's like, oh, they're so seductive. You know, I see one, it's like, oh, I don't have anything like that, and it's so beautiful. And let me just play it so I can hear how it sounds. And it's so alluring. But if you do that, oh, yes, I'm preaching to the choir over here. So pretty soon you have more instruments than you have space for. So Siddhartha was his name, the Buddha. He said, wanting things just makes you always unhappy. Because you need more. You need the next thing. And he said, the second thing we need to realize is anger will kill you. If you get angry, it's going to kill you. Well, it turns out to be truer than any of us knew, really, because they're finding now that anger is one of the largest killers anywhere in the world. You know, anger kills people. It creates bad chemistry in you, right? And so you suffer from that. The third thing that he said that causes people to suffer so much is we make up stories and then we believe them. It is laughable. So every once in a while, Andy and I will be driving in the car and something will happen. We'll go, well, I wonder where they're going. Oh, they're probably, you know, and then we run the storyline that goes with it. And so what Siddhartha was saying is, that we're too good at that. They even had a name for that, you know, in Buddhism, that's what we do. It's like if we don't know the answer, we're going to make something up. Sometimes we make up stuff. If somebody just asks us a question, then we'll give them our best shot at an answer as if we really know what we're talking about. And he's calling that being delusional. So whatever it was that woke up Siddhartha, you know, when he was out there and seeing what really happens in life and all the pain and suffering that people go through, then he realized that I want to tell other people about that. And that became his mission. Well, I'll just say one more thing about Buddhism. It's been around for 2,600 years. The truth is still there, although people adopt it and kind of turn it around the way they want to make it be. And that happens with every religion over time. So we have a lot of folks that are giving you the new spin on old teachings. I'm forever surprised at how many different ways people use the Bible for their own benefit. And it's sad. And, you know, I used to get up every time I spoke, I'd say, we owe an apology to Jesus. You know, because his message was stolen. The religion is no longer about his teachings. It's about whether you're saved or not and whether you're in the in-group of in a certain way. And so if we were able to kind of throw all that stuff aside and just look directly at the teachings of Jesus, it would sound just like the teachings of the Buddha. And it is. It's an amazing thing to me. My own story about a gradual awakening. Can't see the time. Oh, yes. Okay. I'm 77 years old. And when I was a kid, I wanted to be a minister. And I just had a big desire for that. But I went to a church that was a sort of weird. It was a Southern Baptist church. And, you know, they were very strict, and my parents were very strict, and, you know, they just didn't want you to dance or anything like that, and it was kind of tough. And so, also in church, I heard them talking about all the things that would send you to hell. There was just a long list. And so I just thought, well, gosh, they're pretty much describing me there. I don't stand much of a chance in this. So I kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater, and I said, to heck with all of this. I'll do it on my own. And so that I was 18 when that happened. And sort of I lived during the 60s and the 50s. I was growing up. And so I got to be a beatnik, and I got to be a hippie. And that was just the best thing ever. You know, I got exposed to strange religions. I read my first book about Buddhism, I guess, in 1970 or so. And then I went to a sweat lodge. And this old dude who was a psychologist was hosting it. And he was really a neat guy. When he was not working as a psychologist, he went by the name of Silver Fox. And so it was the hippie days, you know. So anyway, so here was Silver Fox and all our little ring of hippies doing the sweat lodge. And I had him do coached breath work with me. If you've ever heard of rebirthing, it's sort of like that, or Stanislav Grof's holotropic breath work. So I had this experience with him, and it creates a gate that opens up from your regular consciousness down into your deeper consciousness, and you never know what you're going to get. So my particular experience that day was that I was in a space that was really quite unfamiliar. My body was moving in ways that I was not controlling, and I had a vision, or some people might call it a hallucination. But for me, I was on a marble slab lying out like this, and I was dying because my arm had been pulled off and I was bleeding out. And there I was, and it was hurting so much. And then all of a sudden, I just left. And then before I made my grand exit out of the room, I looked around, and there I was. And then I wasn't in pain anymore, but I wasn't quite there anymore. And then I sort of had this realization that I was moving to someplace else, you know. And then I realized, oh, that's not really who I was anyway. And then I had this feeling that I was going back to this big collective pool of souls, you know, and that we weren't separate. We were just like, if you were to make a bowl of chili beans, all the chili beans were in the same bowl, you know. And so that was sort of my experience that I had. And that really kind of cracked things for me. And that experience seemed so real, and I had a tendency to downplay it. Like, wow, that was quite a trip. Quite a trip. But I never did forget that feeling of thinking that I was going to some kind of reunion, a spiritual reunion, and that this was really not as significant as I thought it was. So I've not been the same since then. And that was my crack in the egg, and I'm grateful for it. I still can't explain it. I think that when opportunities like that come up and you get to experience something deeper in yourself instead of all the clutter at the top, we should take it. You know, I'm not saying go and do breath work or anything, but I'm just saying if something happens in your life that shakes you up so much that you start questioning the core of who you are, it's an opportunity to reveal your authentic self and to learn from that and to go guided from that. So anyway, I just wanted to share that with you today because it was so interesting to me, and I hadn't really planned on sharing that part until this morning. Early in the morning, I was meditating, and I thought, I need to tell you about this, about that experience. So I just wanted to share it with you. Well, thank you for listening to me. We're going to do an offertory.
He's kidding.
Thank you.
This one is a hymn from Russia. It was commissioned by Catherine the Great to be sung at the cathedral in St. Petersburg. So it's from the late 1700s, and it's called Tibia Paim.
As you leave. You don't have to listen to it, but if you want to sing it, go ahead.